You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. Today we're going to be focused on pensions. And if there's ever an issue that's cried out for a marriage between fact-based economic research and public policy, it's, as we know, it's pensions. Pension liabilities are as big as the debt liability for most governments. They've been crowding out the ability of government to provide basic services, and they've also been the cause of some governments going into Chapter 9. And so today we're going to hear about what sort of impact pension liabilities have on borrowing costs, also how they interact with finances, and then we're going to also hear about what happens in the worst case when you have no flexibility to adjust your pension liabilities. So we're going to, again, the format is 15 minutes of presentation, 10 minutes of the discussants, and then 15 minutes for questions and answers, and we'll try to, you know, facilitate as many questions as we can. We're going to start out with Chuck Boyer from an excellent school, University of Chicago, and he is going to talk to us about the impact of public pensions on borrowing costs. So, Chuck.
All right. Everyone can hear me in the back? Mic's working? Okay, great. So thank you all so much for coming. So my name is Chuck Boyer. I'm a PhD candidate in financial economics at the University of Chicago. I want to thank the conference for having me. I'm really excited to be here to talk a little bit about my research and even more than that to kind of get some feedback to see if what I'm doing is useful, interesting. So I look forward to comments. So just a little motivation for what I'm doing. This kind of is a lot of stuff, honestly, that's pretty obvious to people already in this room. As Mike was just alluding to, a lot of attention that has been paid, and particularly in the academic community, to municipal finance in the last few years has focused a lot on the fact that local governments and states have large underfunded pension liabilities. And it's something that has kind of been swept under the rug for a long time, and it's about time we kind of bring it to the forefront. And kind of two things I want to highlight that kind of motivate my research is, one, a recent paper by Michael Schwert, who's now at Ohio State, kind of looked at where cross-sectional differences in bond yields were, whether they're really being driven by default risk or liquidity risk. And some of his findings suggest that kind of a lot of what's going on in muni bonds is, in fact, default risk and not liquidity risk. And what this kind of does is sets up sort of a challenge for us academics to better understand, okay, what is it, though, that's driving these kind of cross-sectional differences in default risk? And sort of an obvious candidate to look at, and something people in this room are familiar with, is underfunded pension liabilities. To the extent, particularly, that underfunded pension liabilities are sort of crowding out other bonded debt, this kind of increases the default risk of GO bonds, in particular for state governments, which may have an adverse effect on borrowing costs. And kind of another unique feature of these markets is the fact that sort of the legal priority of legal of pension liabilities and also bonded debt are not really set in stone, kind of unlike a corporate environment where you have kind of defined hierarchies of which debt is senior to which. It's unclear from a legal standpoint, at least that's kind of my understanding, that the seniority of pension liabilities as opposed to bonded debt are not set in stone. So kind of with these thoughts in mind, sort of what I'm trying to tackle in this paper are a few questions. First is kind of just, do underfunded pension liabilities affect state borrowing costs? Certainly, I think anecdotally we think yes, but really a lot of what I'm going to try and do is say, okay, quantitatively, but by how much? And what's really the marginal effect of these underfunded pension liabilities on yields for state governments? And then I want to ask questions such as, how does this compare to the effects for actual bonded debt? So if you looked at, for instance, at like a long-term debt coverage ratio for states, how does this effect on yields compare to that for pension liabilities? And then I want to think a little bit about this fact that there's kind of an unknown or uncertain seniority structure between pension liabilities and bonded debt. And I want to ask, how do markets account for the fact that certain states have varying levels of legal protections for pension liabilities? And how does that interact with underfunded pension liability levels themselves? So you can kind of imagine the thought experiment here is that in states with greater legal protections for pension liabilities, markets see them as more senior. So therefore, movements in the funding level for the state are going to have a larger effect on debt spreads. And kind of a couple other political economy questions I tackle kind of in the second part of my paper, which hopefully I'll get to a little bit, is if ultimately what's going to happen in some sort of fiscal crisis or even a default event is some sort of bargaining that goes on between pensioners and debt holders, for instance, like something that happened in Detroit, do states, for instance, with larger union presence, which may be proxies for greater bargaining power for pensioners, are these liabilities seen as more senior in these states and have an adverse effect on borrowing costs? So just a quick preview of my results. Essentially what I find is that a one standard deviation increase in the pension underfunding to GDP ratio for a state government leads to about an 18 basis point increase in credit spreads. These economic magnitudes are similar for bonded debt. And I also find that the effect of these pension underfunding ratios are much stronger in states with stronger protections for pension liabilities. And I think this provides some suggestive evidence that states are taking these constitutional protections as material and factoring them in when setting bond yields. I also find some kind of suggestive evidence that indeed pensioner bargaining power does increase bond yields at the state level, again, suggesting perhaps that the perceived kind of pecking order of these liabilities in a fiscal crisis may be higher. And kind of really the big takeaway thing here is that the idea of underfunded pension liabilities are not really just a problem for down the road. This isn't a problem that the states are not going to be able to pay them in 10 years. I mean, that might be the first order concern. What I'm trying to highlight is that states are already paying higher borrowing costs as a result of these underfunded pensions. So this, I've kind of mostly gone over this. This is a little bit of summary of what I was talking about. So what I do use in the bulk of my paper to proxy for state government borrowing costs is I'm actually using credit default swap spreads, which are traded on state governments. The reason I do use these for the bulk of my paper is that I guess I kind of see them as a cleaner measure of default risk than state bonds. Unlike state bonds, I don't have to worry about varying optionality of contracts, varying different features. There's just less to control for. So kind of the way, for those that aren't familiar, credit default swap contract is essentially a buyer pays a spread to buy insurance against a default risk of an underlying entity. So if, for instance, the state of Illinois defaulted on their bonds, if you own the CDS contract, you would be made whole on whichever bond you had bought protection against. And these contracts are very standardized, so I don't have to worry about varying contracts of different types of GO bonds, for instance. That being said, I will say I do everything kind of in the paper also with underlying bonds themselves, and all my results are qualitatively similar, so I'm not too concerned about it biasing the results. These are just some summary stats for people who aren't familiar with what these look like. So one of the drawbacks of the CDS are that they're only actually traded on 27 of the 50 states during my time period. Unsurprisingly, you see things like spreads kind of increasing during the financial crisis and coming down. Similar patterns that you would see if I just looked at average statistics for GO bonds. So what am I doing to kind of control for fiscal conditions at a state level and also pension funding? So I've collected a bunch of balance sheet information from comprehensive annual financial reports from state governments. I'll talk a little bit about the kind of specific variables I use. And I use this both to control for other fiscal conditions that aren't at least directly related to pension underfunding, so that I can try and get at the marginal effects of pension funding on bond yields. And I supplement this with sort of the public pension plan data from BC Center for Retirement Research to calculate the actual pension funding ratios for each state in my sample. So it's kind of the main analysis I'm doing here is I'm just kind of running simple regressions of the level of the credit spread for each state and year on kind of my main variable of interest is this pension funding ratio, where I look at the amount of pension assets minus the pension liabilities, and I scale by each state's GDP. I scale each kind of variable by GDP to just kind of standardize across states with different sizes. There's nothing special about GDP. My results are very similar if I use, for instance, something like income at the state level or revenue. And so all in all, I have, by looking at kind of the fiscal data, I have 212 observations from 2005 to 2016. And I'll kind of just, at this point, jump into the results. So kind of what you're looking at here, so the other variables in my main specification that I'm kind of controlling for, I look at the revenue minus expense ratio as a share of GDP, current assets minus current liabilities, and long-term assets minus long-term liabilities, in addition to kind of this bottom line item here in the top half of the panel, which is kind of my main variable of interest, which is the pension asset to pension liability ratio. And kind of what this, if you look particularly at column four here, kind of the main finding, this coefficient of the 17.94, what you can think of this as is a state year observation with a one standard deviation improved pension funding ratio is going to have an 18-point decrease in their credit spreads. And kind of one concern that you might get from looking at this is that really what this is being driven by is sort of other underlying economic factors that are going on at a state level. So kind of in my next table, what I do is I add two additional control variables to account for this. So the one, this econ index, is the Philadelphia Fed's coincidence index, which essentially is an index of economic activity at a state level, and also a housing price index for each state. So again, if you look kind of in column five here, I'm now controlling for some additional underlying economic conditions and showing that kind of my main results are unchanged. The coefficient on the pension funding ratio has decreased a little bit to about 16, but still very statistically significant. So kind of, again, the takeaway here is that these pension funding ratios are having a large effect on the magnitude of 16, 18 basis points on credit spreads. And it's similar if you look at the same coefficient on this long-term asset coverage ratio, the A minus LTL. They're in a similar ballpark, which suggests that markets are kind of accounting for these pension liabilities in a similar magnitude as they would count for any other bonded obligation. So kind of, I just kind of summarize this. My main results, again, are this fact that pension funding ratios, a one standard deviation change in them, seems to have about an 18 basis point effect on spreads. I don't have it in the slides here, but in the paper, I also go through kind of, for the econ wonks in here, an instrumental variable exercise where I instrument for the pension funding ratio using pension asset returns to kind of try and show that this really is a causal relationship, which I'm sure is not surprising to most people in this room. But it really does seem to be that markets are taking into account these pension funding ratios when setting bond yields. So what's sort of the magnitude of these effects just beyond the basis point? So this is sort of a, kind of like a back of the envelope calculation here. So, for instance, if you took the state of Illinois, if they got up to full pension funding ratio, essentially based on my regression results, what this would result in is about a 60 basis point improvement in spreads. And if you look at Illinois with about $26 billion in outstanding general obligation debt, if they're paying an additional 60 basis points on each dollar of this debt every year, they're paying about $160 million in borrowing costs each year just due to these pension underfunding ratios. Again, kind of one of my main takeaways here being that state governments are already paying for these underfunded liabilities in the form of high borrowing costs. So kind of the second main area I focus on in my paper is looking at differences in constitutional protections for pension liabilities across states. So certain states within their constitutions have either explicit protections for pension liabilities, saying that state governments must pay these out prior to any other obligations. And there's also some weaker contract-level protections for pension liabilities. So I'm using kind of definitions by Monell and Quimby here of these constitutional protections. And what I want to look at is now how do pension funding levels, their effect on spreads, change across states based on these legal protections? Essentially, are markets taking them into account? Does it sound like they're material? So what I add now to kind of my main specifications are a couple interaction terms where I'm looking either at this explicit protection dummy variable or just a protected dummy variable interacting with the pension funding level ratio. And I'm showing that there's essentially, if you look, for instance, at column three, a lot of what's going on, this effect of the underfunding on debt spreads, is being driven particularly by the states in which there's constitutional protections. So essentially, what I'm kind of surmising here is that markets see these protections as material. They see these pension liabilities as more senior in these states. And therefore, the movements in the pension liabilities are crowding out more of the debt in these states and leading to larger movements in spreads. Kind of really quickly, I'll talk a couple other results. So I now look a couple proxies for union involvement in a state, both union membership and political donations by unions in a state. In columns 2 and 4, you see kind of it's weaker on the statistical significance, but the direction's going the right way. States with higher union presence are seeing higher borrowing costs. I don't really have a great causal story for this, but you could create stories where markets see pension liabilities in the states as more senior because pensioners have greater bargaining, would have greater bargaining power in a fiscal crisis, and they're factoring that into bond yields today. And kind of my last main result, I also look at whether pension funding at a local level matters for state borrowing costs. So now I'm just looking at the pension funding ratio for the localities within a state. So for instance, if you look at column 3 here, you see a similar magnitude effect for local pension funding on state government borrowing costs. And you could tell stories where if a government, so I also look at whether states are kind of proactive. In the definition of Paul Gao, who's, I think, presenting in the other room right now, in the paper they had done, and looking at whether this has an effect on the yields themselves, the idea being that perhaps states who are more willing to help out localities in trouble might be dividing more resources to help them with pensions in a crisis and are therefore seeing higher borrowing costs today because of that expected future cost. So just to kind of wrap up, so kind of my main result here is I find that pension funding has a strong and robust statistical relationship with borrowing costs at the state level. A one standard deviation improvement in the pension funding to GDP ratio is associated with an 18 basis point decrease in spreads. And I find some suggestive evidence that markets take legal protections for these liabilities seriously and that pension are having a larger effect on spreads in states where they are seen as more senior. And again, kind of my main takeaway is that this isn't just, the pension problem is not just a problem for down the road when we have an inability to pay. This is something that governments are already facing in the form of higher borrowing costs. Thank you.
Okay, my name is Natalie Cohen. I am in charge of municipal research at Wells Fargo Securities, so sell-side research. I'm not a statistician, so some of the numbers, you know, I need to go back to my grad school days myself and say, how does this standard deviation work exactly? And I also want to just say, I think it's terrific to have a paper like this that is showing the consequences today of issues that a lot of governments are kicking down the road to later and kind of shoving under the rug. And I think that, you know, we need to do more of this. So my comments in that context, I have a couple of quibbles that I'd like to take. I did discuss these with the author, and you know, I think that some of them are actually kind of universal sort of misunderstandings or generalizations that we see a fair amount, and I think it's important to take the good statistical work like this and not extend it into some, and I'm going to get into that. I'm going to talk a little bit about the choice of the proxy of the credit default swap, a little bit about the attempt to associate union involvement with higher spreads, and then the term bailout, which Chuck didn't mention here, but was in the paper a fair amount. I find a very loaded term, and I think underneath it there's a lot of discussion about that should be had about states that have oversight over local governments and also what that actually entails, whether it's, you know, bailout implies I'm going to pay for something that you're not paying for and I'm going to take it over. And I don't think that's exactly what's happening out there, and it's a bit of a loaded term, I find. And then finally, another area is in terms of actually distinguishing plans in a pension. I see this across the board. I see this in some of the Pew studies. I see this in Bloomberg and in a lot of different well-respected writers that just talk about a state plan as if it's a uniform, single plan, whereas underneath it, you have the state employees in a plan, you have the local employees, and I think there's a lot of distinction. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. So first, to just dispense with the CDS issue, Chuck mentions that they are liquid. They're not. And if you talk to market, there's really very limited trading that actually takes place. They have a sophisticated modeling system that is actually based on muni bond prices. So the fact that his work is showing that if you did go to the muni bond pricing, you come up with very similar, consistent results is partly because of that. And so I think we can take that off the table and dispense with that criticism, because he does end up in the same place if you look at muni bonds. And I agree, yes, there's call optionality and all kinds of murky stuff in our muni world, and CDS is a cleaner statistic to work with. But I think it's important not to call them liquid. Because it's not, it's just not. Okay, so, and I was glad actually he concluded, you know, the union and collective bargaining issue. I mean, I would say New York State has the highest union participation of any of the states in the country, and there's a list going down, and Illinois is not among the top new numbers. So I think there's some bias in there to like try to pull that out and say it's because the unions are paying politicians. There are lots of other PACs and entities that are paying politicians to get elected to express and represent their views. And I think, I think that he did point out that none of the coefficients were statistically significant there. Back to the New York example, New York's pension systems are generally better funded than many of the other systems. So I think that that's at least one large example. The other thing I think in terms of bond pricing that's important and does come out in the numbers is a number of counterpoints. One I would mention, you know, the state of California, and you had that in your chart of the spreads. California's spread gapped out huge when they had, right after the recession, we had the huge financial markets downturn, and California had a significant deficit. $27 billion is what stays in my mind. California's tax structure is very heavily tied to capital gains tax, and you can map it. I've mapped it in some charts that there's this huge volatility that takes place when the financial markets are up. They've got surpluses. When financial markets are down, they have deficits that come out. Other states like the state of Illinois and others that have the state income tax tied that taxes capital gains also have that kind of volatility. And so that was, I think, a point at which in fact, the rating agencies, or S&P in particular, had lowered California to an A- at a certain point in time, which was lower than the rating on Puerto Rico. Just pointing that out as a side fact. They got a little beef on that one, but they did, you know, they have readjusted and come back up. And the second factor is the commodity states. We've seen tremendous fluctuation in the oil and gas states in terms of their fiscal condition, their ability to pay into their funds and their pricing in the markets and their rating downgrades. So the rating agencies have taken that into account as well. So I'm just throwing in some counterpoints of other factors that affect bond pricing in a pretty significant way. The other thing that was kind of interesting in looking at his time series work, I think there was some noticeable shifting when the Gatsby rules took hold. And so it might be worth looking at the time series in terms of other external things that might have caused such as transparency and the awareness that pension liabilities are an issue. I think in spite of a lot of proclamations that the rating agencies have always taken pensions into account, there's been significant downgrades, particularly at the state level, for underfunded pensions in the last year and a half to 2 years. So that also has an impact on pricing. The issue of bailout, just to talk about that, like I said, that's a loaded term. If you look at, people hold up North Carolina as an example. North Carolina and New Jersey, after the Great Depression, implemented oversight of their local governments. And what's involved in that is a pre-default or pre-stress look. And having traveled in and out of North Carolina a fair amount and talked to local government, they would consistently say to me, oh, we could never do that. The North Carolina Government Commission would never let us do that. They accept it. They live with it. They don't see it as a compromise of their local power. That probably took place in the late 30s, early 40s, where they fought that battle. But they consistently have higher ratings and, I would argue, lower cost of borrowing. Two more minutes? Okay. I'm almost there. So to the point about separating out the plans, I think if you look at, in Illinois, the IMRF, which is the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, it's better funded. Why? The governments were made to put their money in. In North Carolina, they will evaluate a local government's budget, and if you don't have the money in your budget, as you should, over time, then your budget's not going to get accepted. New Jersey local government has looked at it the same way, where you have to have your budget put together with the proper pay-ins in place. So the local government plan in New Jersey is also better funded than the state-level plan. The IMRF is better funded. I think that cuts across as well to some entities in Connecticut and also in Pennsylvania, where there's been oversight, I wouldn't say bailout. So I think it's important to tease some of those factors out in doing this. And also the other important factor is the difference between the agency and the cost share plans. That is something that gets slushed over a fair amount. There have been papers written about the cost share plan. To my mind, if you just take a step back and say, why would we want a state legislature deciding how much money should get paid into a plan versus a series of actuaries and a series of rigorous studies about the assumptions? But the cost share plans do tend to have poorly funded pension plans. And those are for school districts, universities, teachers, and so on to a large extent. So that would be the difference between CalPERS and CalSTRS in California. And so I wanted to make that point. So ultimately, and we did talk about this over the phone, the issue is really, paying in. If you're forced to pay in and you pay in and have consistently and regularly over time, yes, you'll be subject to market fluctuation and you'll have losses depending on your investment strategy. But not paying in is a critical component of some of the problems that we have today. And that's been true for Chicago, for Illinois, Kentucky, Connecticut, even Ben Watkins in well-managed Florida yesterday mentioned a pension holiday that they had to put in effect because of their budget issues. So, okay, I got the time thing here.
Do you want to be in the middle? Or do you want to
I can sit at the end.
I guess you turn this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to open it for questions, but I just want to start with a couple observations. One thing I would say is throughout this conference, it seems like the rating agencies keep getting beaten up. For full disclosure, I've worked for Fitch Ratings for 15 years, but I would say similar to GASB putting the liability on the balance sheet, I think the rating agencies have really done a good job of making the pension liability more transparent and measuring it as debt and stress testing it with different discount rates. And I think that has been embraced by the market in terms of how they value, and of course the rating is one thing, but just how they value debt and what sort of interest rate people pay. Similar to Natalie's question about oversight and bailouts, and you had mentioned that when it's more likely that there would be a bailout, that would lead to higher borrowing costs for the state government, you know, because people would perceive that they're going to have to put resources in. And I would just echo what Natalie said, and it's in most places where they have fiscal emergency laws, you know, those are usually precede any sort of risk that a pension payment won't be made. And, you know, there's some as strong as North Carolina where your budget doesn't get approved, and then there are states like Michigan that really step in to try to reorganize your finances so that you can meet these obligations. So those were just two observations I had on the paper.
Oh, the one with the mouth and the words or something coming out. Okay, sorry. And I think also the other point, and this is true for Michigan and Detroit, you have a state legislature in there that has to actually approve any kind of a, quote, bailout. You know, if you followed the sequence of the grand bargain that took place with Detroit, the legislature was not, you know, they weren't on board very easily, and there was certainly a lot of heavy discussion from the upstate or outside the Detroit area folks. That's certainly true in Illinois. The non, you know, Chicagoland, Cook County areas wouldn't necessarily vote for an easy bailout, and then at the end of the day, they did go along with the plan, but they present valued the dollar amount so that it was smaller, so it minimized the impact on the state. So I just wanted to mention you do have sort of some friction with legislative approvals on any kind of a bailout.
And you do have to have an art collection to take that.
Well, they were had an asset.
Any points?
I will just say, I appreciate the comment. I think kind of my language in the paper where, so I didn't get into this as much in the presentation, but I do have a section where I look at kind of pension funding at the local level and see what effect that might be having on state borrowing costs. And as you mentioned, I look kind of at this feral proactive that Gao et al. Had used. And I think you're right. It's not about bailouts, and I shouldn't really talk about it that way. To me, it's just some sort of proxy for markets perceiving kind of greater involvement at a state level, which could perceivably take resources. That being said, my results on that kind of front are kind of weak to begin with, so it's probably not there at all, or if anything, very small. So,
great. Good questions? Questions from the audience?
Hey, Louise Shanner. So I had a question about holding constant economic conditions, which I think in general makes sense, but you might think, I mean, the pension holiday example kind of brought it to mind, which is sometimes it makes sense from an economic perspective to not make a pension contribution, right? It might, like, you might actually have a better recovery from a recession if you don't cut back on state and local spending so much. So you're kind of taking that out. So it could be that the net effect of not making a pension contribution is actually positive for your borrowing, I mean, it lowers your borrowing costs, but you're holding constant the outcome of that. So I don't know if you had thought about that at all.
No, I think that's an interesting point. I think after having conversations about this, one thing I do kind of want to look at more seriously is about what's actually going into the pension funding and looking that separate than just kind of the funding level itself. It's important. Markets presumably see something very different between two equally underfunded pensions, but one that's like on the right path towards paying them off and one that isn't. And I think your point is probably correct. So kind of my results looking, for instance, at constitutional protections for states and the idea that a lot of this effect of the underfunding is kind of concentrated in states where there are greater legal protections for pensions means there is sort of some dynamic going on here. It's not just about the pension level. It's about also how senior they're seeming or presumably like whether they're on the right path, paying them kind of as they should be. So,
question here.
Can I follow up on that, Carol O'Clerican? I was curious as to how statistically you deal with a situation like Illinois, which didn't have a budget for 2 years. I mean, the interaction of all of these factors, I mean, if you added up all the negatives, right, for Illinois, it's more than just pensions. And so I'm curious as to whether you have statistically a way to deal with that or you just ignore it.
So I guess the short answer is what I showed today is I do kind of ignore it. It is at face value. I'm showing you what I'm kind of controlling for. I do kind of in the paper go through a slightly more rigorous kind of statistical exercise where I look at an instrumental variable exercise where I essentially proxy for pension funding level by your return on your pension assets. The idea being there that just the return you get on your assets in a given year is kind of random. It's not necessarily correlated with other things you're doing at a state level. And that tries to tease out sort of a more causal relationship between just the pension funding level itself and the debt yields. But I think your point is taken that there is a lot, certainly, that's going on at a specific state level, for instance, somewhere like Illinois with not passing budgets that I'm not explicitly capturing.
Yeah, yet. And as an economist, I'm going to sort of press it further mm-hmm. because I've always been very conscious as to the crude variables we end up having to use in these kind of econometrics and how unsatisfactory they are. And I was looking at your union one thinking, oh, well, anybody looking at Detroit would say highly unionized and whatever. But if you really look at the data, Michigan is now a right-to-work state. And it kind of depends on how you, what point in time, right, when you're actually doing it and when it might have affected any of your other variables. So it's so murky to try to get these kind of real-world realities into statistics. So I think the broad brush of what you did is a really good thing to do. And then you just start getting into the details. It gets more and more spongy.
And it is important to walk away from some of the details and actually be able to put a paper together without, you know, 1,000 bullet holes in it. But I wanted to just mention, back to Louise's point about decision-making and the cost of borrowing for a state. It may be the right decision at that point in time for the economy to say we're going to take a pension holiday. I don't think the markets, because you're going to be doing that in a bad time, in a tough economic time. And so I don't think the markets would necessarily say, oh, this is the right decision. They're going to come back around and start putting the money back in, and we'll give them credit for that in the bond pricing.
Well,
so
they don't have to realize that's what's going on. It could be that the forecasts improve, and they say, oh, well, economic conditions aren't as bad, so I give them credit for that. Right? So the market doesn't have to understand the causality for it to still be a factor, right, which is if actually not firing your teachers improves your economic outlook, then that, and it's because you didn't make the pension contribution that you didn't have to fire your teachers, then it may well be that you get a better recovery, and so that you can price both. But in the causality, you kind of want to take them both into account.
Right behind you.
Laurel Pressing from Urbana, Illinois. Illinois has a 3% increase every year for pensions. People who are receiving pensions, and I just wonder, is that done in other states?
The compounding of the
you're talking
benefit.
About cost of living adjustment?
Yeah.
COLAs?
Yeah, it's compounded.
Yes. It's a flat 3%, and when it was instituted, it wasn't very big, but it's just this giant thing that's eating up the state?
There are a lot of different varieties and flavors of various annual adjustments, and some are ad hoc and some are baked into the numbers. So, you know, they originated in a very high inflationary time period, and we've obviously not had that for quite a long time, so it's excessively above what, you know, what the true cost of living adjustment is. But there, and there is a range of legal decisions that have been made. Courts have heard arguments pro and con on the cost of living. Colorado, I'm thinking of, Minnesota, and so on. So, yeah, it's out there. It's definitely out there.
Hi, this is Laura from the Center for Retirement Research. I just want to talk about the COLA really quickly. So the flat, the 3% you're referring to is supposed to be a cost of living adjustment. Obviously, it's not tracking with inflation, but I'd also like to add in Illinois, it's at the, for new hires right now, it's a simple COLA. It's not compounding. So it's actually a lot less generous than you might think at first glance. That's a trend that we've been noticing. The COLA has seemed to be one of the easiest benefits to cut, especially for current employees. It's the first thing on the chopping block. And also in Illinois, the workers are not in Social Security. So the pension is their only DB retirement income that they have.
Let me get over on this side here.
Thanks. I'm Bill Glasgow from Volcker Alliance. Just a couple of questions and comments. I don't know if it's proper to say that an X increase in pension funding or an X decrease in pension funding results in an increase in borrowing costs or credit costs for the government, because there's the stock of debt and then there's new debt. So if you take a lot of Illinois' debt is already on the books. If the spreads widen, the ones who are going to that affects the investors. That doesn't affect Illinois. So you have to really roll over the entire stock of debt to get the numbers you're working at. It's a common thing. To say at when I was at Bloomberg, we would make that, we would throw that into stories, but it's not correct. Your point is right. It's a slow process. Eventually, Illinois will end up paying that as all the debt rolls over, if it can. So that's something to consider. The other thing to consider is the structure of debt. Chicago has one of the worst pension underfunding problems anywhere on earth. They just did a general obligation bond that was well received. It punched above its weight in terms of spreads because it was structured to be bankruptcy remote or bankruptcy unlikely. And of course, you have the New York City. You have sales tax bonds, personal income tax bonds. The extreme was the Puerto Rican COFINAs, which that turned out so well. But when they were issued, they were AAA. Puerto Rico was not a AAA credit. So you got to look. I think. If you go back at this, you should look at the structure of the state debt and not just use CDS spreads or Bloomberg indicative spreads. But you need to look at like a clean GO spread.
So if I could just two things. One, you're completely right about the first point. I have that slide, sort of the magnitude of the effects, where I do that calculation. That's not even in the paper. It's something because I should have said something immediately that's exactly right. That's if they rolled everything over. On the second point, I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. What was the? Oh, the structure. Sure. So part of the reason originally I did use CDS was to kind of avoid some of these issues that I didn't have to worry about the structure. And when I do it with GO bonds in the paper, I try at least to make some effort using a lot of what I can get out of Mergent anyway to control for a lot of the structural features of the debt in addition to kind of the other characteristics that I have here.
Great. All right, we're gonna move on to our next presenters. We're out of time, but you know, certainly feel free to ask questions. Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. The topic that I'm going to talk about is what happens when you've raised taxes to the highest degree you can practically. You've cut your cost as much as you believe you can without losing taxpayers, corporate and individual. And you've reduced services to a level where it becomes questionable. How do you solve it if there's just no room left in the legal ways of doing it? And on a consensual basis, you can't get there consensually. And I want to start by saying, number one, obviously, consensual resolution is the best. Secondly, we need to foster the full payment of pensions, the raising of taxes, and dealing with balanced budgets. But we cannot wind up with the fear of crowding out essential services. We saw from Detroit over their period of time prior to going into a Chapter 9 that if you raise taxes and lower services, people move out. Bridgeport, Connecticut in the late 80s and beginning of the 90s suffered the same phenomena. And you go through history. And so we don't want to have the municipality fail because we didn't address the problem. The second purpose of the paper is to make sure that if we have a problem today, address it today. Don't worry about tomorrow or the next day because it may only get worse. And so we need to address it. Now, first of all, we have 4,000 pension funds. I'm not saying all of them or a whole majority of them may need some of these solutions, but there are clearly some. And in various states, because of economic legacy costs, businesses moving out, changes in the economy, there are going to be needs for ways of solving it other than having the municipality melt. Credit analysts, when surveyed, when they asked what is the biggest concern they have, 92% mentioned the pension issues as that. There's been all sorts of reform done. Over 40-some states have done pension reforms in the recent history. There have been litigation, and about 80% of the litigation has turned out to allow some form of adjustment. It has to be reasonable and rational. It has to be proportional, but they have allowed it. So that there is a movement, and many of the states are solving it. So often when we talk about, and if you talk to mayors, the last thing they want to do is go into a Chapter 9. They don't want to be the mayor that put the city in. You know, the other remedies that you have are always difficult to talk about. But one of the things that mayors and other state officials seem to like is, can we have some federal court can deal with pension funds to get them in the right mode? And can we deal with funding our essential services? That seems more acceptable to them than putting the whole city in. Oversight, which you've heard, and obviously Mayor Broden was a good example. MARM, following the footsteps of PICA and MAC and control boards, is a good example of supervision can lead to a solution. But sometimes you need something more, and that's what we're going to be talking about. You know, we've talked about the reforms, and, you know, sometimes people say, is there really a need? I think if you go about the country, you're going to find in a number of the states a real need for something more, something that is beyond where we are legally today. There are some interesting movements. You know, in Illinois, obviously, people bring up Illinois, but part of the problem is, and it isn't, Illinois has a lot of problems. Net migration out is 5%. In New York, it's 5.5% net migration out over the last 10 years. So if you look at those numbers, it's not just pensions. It's a number of factors. But we've got to make sure we put it right because that cloud can have some adverse effect. The recent Supreme Court case pending in California dealing with can we have more flexibilities? Does the California rule have room to provide flexibilities, I think is important. Because if there isn't flexibilities, then we're going to need more of these more drastic steps. And one thing I can tell you from having lived in the sort of the back end of finance and both from a funding and also from operations for municipalities, nobody wants to be there. And sometimes you need some very clear alternatives to help people get there voluntarily. So I view some of these as providing for that. unplanned Chapter 9s. Unplanned Chapter 9s don't work well. You heard Mayor Broden talk about prepackage. The reason why is since Detroit in 2013, no city, town, village, or county, with the exception of Liberty View, Kentucky, that went into Chapter 9 to renegotiate a bad trucking lease. And once it was renegotiated, got themselves out of Chapter 9 without doing a plan. The reason why, cost, expense, the uncertitude, and normally you don't like the result. So given all that, people sort of look at it and they say, look, there has to be something we can do before we get there. We've only had 680 Chapter 9s since 1937. I mean, that's not what you call a landslide. And so people use it as a last resort. I'm saying to use it as a last resort if absolutely necessary. Vallejo, the experience in Vallejo taught us one thing. It taught us that it's very important in these situations to deal with the problem. Vallejo did not deal with their pension issue. They cut their first responders basically in half. They had a budget deficit within 2 years after coming out of Chapter 9. And there, you know, all sorts of talks about do they need to go back in. So you need to address pension issues if it is a problem. And Stockton, again, the court recognized that you can make changes to pensions. However, given the uniqueness of CalPERS and some of the outcomes, if you did do it, the municipality decided not to. Detroit, they decided that the constitutional protection was not there in a Chapter 9, that in Chapter 9, the land of broken promises, basically you can basically deal with pensions effectively. Now, again, for the sake of keeping our municipalities functioning, as I tell people who want to rush off and make changes to pensions, if you have some grand plan that you're going to do it and cut pensions, who are you going to get to type it? You know, you need your workers under you to perform. And so it's important to do something. The best results have been working with the unions and getting a consensual deal if you can. Now, willingness to pay. There should be no tolerance for unwillingness to pay. If you got the money, if you can raise taxes, if you've cut wherever you can and you still have problems, this is what we're talking about. Now, the essential mission of government is provide services at an acceptable level for their people. The health, safety, and welfare of the people are the key of state and local governments. That's what the Supreme Court, our Constitution, provide. Now, what are some of the solutions? The first, and even Mayor Broden talked about it, I think we moved on. Prepackage. Why do I say prepackage? And I'll go into it in the description, but it's a way of quickly doing it, not lingering in Chapter 9, which costs you time, money, and threatens the result. The creation of a special court under the federal government's powers to deal with insolvent pension funds. And this would be separate and apart. It would be specially geared towards helping the pension get as much funding as they can while not crowding out essential services, recognizing the state and local government need to provide for that. As far as oversight, creating similar to what we've seen with MAC, with PICA, MARM from in Connecticut, that was what Hartford is in now, Tier 3, is a form of oversight. Over the years, there have been an increasing, whether it's Act 47 Pennsylvania, control boards in New York, emergency managers in Michigan and in Indiana, an increase in some form of oversight and providing financing. And I think providing additional sources of revenue to people who are in distress to bridge the illiquidity makes some sense. So first of all, the prepackage. And this follows what we learned from corporate bankruptcies. You know, you can go into corporate bankruptcy as a free fall. Nobody knows what it is. There's uncertainty. Everybody jockeys for position. Before you file in a prepack, you have already talked to all of your constituency. You have given them the financial information that is adequate information to make the decision. You have given them a proposed restructuring, negotiated it with them, have a number of people or classes of creditors that are on board, so you have acceptance of it. You have a vote of them and an acceptance. So when you go into the Chapter 9, you wind up talking about a couple of months, 3-4 months at most. And you can go in with speed, with certitude, from the standpoint of the workers and the suppliers and the creditors, it gives them more certitude of result. It also allows you to put pressure on people who may be unwilling to make it, unreasonably unwilling to make it, to make a concession, because they know if you go into a Chapter 9, you already have a class accepting it, you're going to have a confirmation where it could be a train coming down the tracks that you'll be run over. With regard to creation of a special bankruptcy court, a special bankruptcy court would be created. There would be, it would be staffed by judges and other staff with the skill and ability in finance and negotiation with regard to unions, with regard to labor relations and pensions, and it would provide and review and approve after giving people an opportunity to comment on a recovery plan proposed by the employer with input, obviously, from the unions, from the workers, and from other creditor constituencies. And it would be a holistic plan. It would not just be for pensions. If pensions have to be changed, obviously, it would then involve the workers and the retirees. If they don't need to be changed, it's just a question of reaching an agreement on a different form of payout, then the court would do that. It would be part of the plan. And so the legislation would be there. Then the oversight. We go through the oversight. I think you're familiar with the variations on this. This is a little more intense because there'd be voluntary resolution through mediation. There'd be a commissioner geared towards mediation, a commissioner of the GORDAC to deal with information and discovery and transparency, and one that would act like the chief judge, who would be the one in charge of hearings and determinations. If you can't get it done voluntarily, it turns into quasi-judicial. They determine what is sustainable and affordable. The plan has to be, the recovery plan, which is a long-term plan, has to be consistent with those financial determinations. And ultimately, if people don't agree to it, you wind up possibly using a prepackaged plan to resolve it. And the last is creating either for a constitutional amendment or a funding policy. And this basically follows some of the better practices that some of the states and local governments already follow. First of all, you have to balance your budget. And as you know, whenever we talk about balancing budget, we have most states have some provision for balancing a budget, at least on the state level, and many have also on the local level. Sometimes we honor it by getting close but not necessarily there. It's important to start with a balanced budget. You've got to pay the actuary-determined contribution. You have to use reasonable and necessary modifications. To the degree any modification is necessary, and this assumes raising taxes to the highest degree possible without breaking the municipality, cutting expenses to the highest degree without sacrificing services and infrastructure improvements at an acceptable level, and then doing whatever adjustment may be necessary to pay as much as you can on pensions, but keep the balanced budget and keep the municipality operating. Fully funding, reasonable modifications, and if you impair any pension rights, there will be like a bond validation. You will go immediately to court for declaratory judgment and termination as to the appropriateness. So you don't sit there and wait to get sued. It isn't a question of when the shoe will drop. There'll be, you have to get that determination in order to basically move forward with your resolution and your budget. There's priorities will be made. We talked about court validation. Public pensions should be affordable and sustainable. Going forward, there would be a determination that they can afford it. You just don't add benefits without proving that you can do it. You have to have legislative findings about the existence of a governmental emergency. Modifications are mandated for the public good. If it's not for the public good, there's no change. Any modification has to be reasonable, and has to be the impairment has to be the least impairment possible while meeting the goals or of balanced budget, et cetera. The harm to the pensioners due to the modification is to be outweighed by the harm suffered by the governmental entity. So if you're not addressing a public good and a public harm that balances out that way, you're not able to make any changes. Financial credibility of the government entity is to be preserved because you need to go forward and you need to fund it. Any modification is really not an impairment because, as the Supreme Court said in Asbury Park, which was in New Jersey City back during the Depression, if you don't have the money to pay, what is the impairment? Because realistically, there's no ability to pay, no funds to pay. So there's legal basis, and you can look at the paper on that, but basically the police power to provide for the health, safety, and welfare is key, and that's where the strength and the importance of this come from. I won't spend any time on that. At the end of the day, the reason why we need to do these things is we can't have the government fail because we didn't provide for essential services and infrastructure. It also hopefully helps people get on the same page. It isn't labor versus employer. It's everybody together. Taxpayers, workers, and retirees have the same goal: a better, stronger, economically solvent government and community is the one that's going to be able to pay pensions. If you don't, and if you don't provide the services at an acceptable level, you won't be able to pay them, and everybody suffers. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Jim Spiato wrote the book on Muni bankruptcy, literally. And he's always provided really useful and interesting discussions in these conferences. This is a lengthy paper. This presentation, you know, couldn't have done it justice. I can't do it justice either. I suggest you may want to look at it. But here, his thesis, the thesis in the paper, is that to satisfy public employee pension liabilities in some states and localities now threatens their very purpose, requiring legal options beyond Chapter 9, which he argues is too expensive and time-consuming. So he offers us in the paper four, and I'm going to quote here, conceptual proposals to be further refined and developed, starting with prepackaged Chapter 9 and escalating ultimately to federal permission for emergency actions to strip away state constitutional protections for pensions. All are couched in a legal justification that states cannot abdicate their government power to provide essential services. Jim's premise is that public pension liabilities are unsustainable. Now, this is not a legal argument, so I feel on safe ground, and I'm not convinced. Before the two latest financial crises, public pension funds were in good shape. Indeed, Alicia Munoz's work showed us they were even overfunded. They took a hit, and they're now recovering. I like Herb Stein's law. If something can't go on forever, it's going to stop. And it has. As Jim admits and showed us, courts, legislatures, and negotiators have taken to heel what he calls the unsustainable. Since 2009, every state has made meaningful changes to their pension plan benefit structures, financing arrangements, or both. Retiree health benefits, OPEB, are generally not an entitlement. The costs are now reported on balance sheets, and they're going to continue to be lowered, but not without harm to many. The standard approach to pension reform has been to reduce the employer costs, starting with new employees who have no protection. In the case of existing employees, there's a variety of ways to save costs, depending on the state's legal, political, and bargaining environment. And even the California rule is likely to get judicial modification. Neither am I convinced that meeting pension obligations ultimately threatens budget sustainability. Nothing in his proposals brings long-term budget reforms. No mandatory multi-year financial plans or budgeting by GAAP rather than cash.
Legislatures and governors can make these changes, and indeed, many have required them of fiscally troubled cities, which you point out and which Mayor Bronin pointed out last night. Most states have responded to the last two financial crises through mandating larger reserves and changes in tax policy, some of which Kim Rubin took us through in yesterday's session. Budget numbers and pension liability calculations are not written in stone. They change at least annually with demographic and financial experience. Detroit, using a multi-year financial plan, has now transformed a looming cliff of pension liability in 2024 into a longer, gentler slope by creating a retiree protection fund into which it is annually paying budgeted revenues and reserves, and that produced a credit upgrade. Admittedly, governments cannot pay, and here I'm going to quote Jim, cannot pay what they do not have. Fortunately, they have taxing power. But in more than a few states, there's been an unwillingness, not an inability, an unwillingness to pay pension contributions. And Natalie made an allusion to that in her remarks. How do we know? We can look at the choices or the revealed preferences or the foregone revenues over time. And the new GASB 77 requirement to report the value of tax incentives offers improved transparency to some of these foregone revenues. So now we know, for example, that the annual cost of funding pensions represents only 69% of the annual cost of Kentucky's reported corporate tax subsidies, and that state is not alone. Also, in case you're not aware, there are at least 16 states where employees' state income tax withholding never gets to the tax collector. Instead, the employer keeps it as a tax break. Opaque to employees and almost everybody else, this revenue loss is happening today in Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Kentucky, and New Jersey, which have very troubled pension systems. Of course, these are policy choices to limit budget revenues, which makes them removable through legislative action. In addition, this paper simply ignores the dynamic nature of budgeting. A host of opportunities are going to come up to help improve longer-term fiscal balance. Today, I could tick off a source list of possible revenues, conformity or nonconformity with federal tax changes, taxing carried interest, legalization of marijuana and sports betting, the taxation of online sales, changing ACA and Medicaid rules. Tomorrow, mandatory Social Security participation could save costs through benefit integration, particularly for teachers' pension systems. And always, states are seeking the consolidation of local governments for efficiencies. Finally, Jim signals out and designates pension problems as causing a government emergency. Why? Today, there are a limited number of states with accumulated debts, some of which are employee-related, that have chosen over the years not to address them. Illinois, New Jersey, Kentucky, Massachusetts and Connecticut, Oregon, California, a few others, depending on how you measure the indebtedness. Most are heavily indebted in the old-fashioned way, too, through borrowing. They have multiple political and governance issues. You know, kicking the can down the road is rarely confined to pension funding. Still, he proposes a federal bankruptcy court for insolvent pension funds, which would formally segregate employee-related debt from bonded debt. I think this is kind of forum shopping, and to me, it is unrealistic. Practical obstacles make it unlikely to be neat, cheap, or quick. You need state legislative sign-off. You have to worry about how you're going to define fund insolvency. I mean, what degree of underfunding are you going to make the cut? There's a large number, as Natalie pointed out, of employee-related plans. They involve multiple employers, multiple employee groups, some overlapping and some quite independent, especially in higher ed. Conceptually, too, it raises the issue of moral hazard, especially given egregious non-funders. Why not just let the states get access to Chapter 9 or some modified version, some resolution mechanism to settle all indebtedness in one place? Now, I suspect that if a Chapter 9 type model were pushed for dealing with all state indebtedness, bondholders wouldn't like it. They believe their claims should be satisfied first in a creditor's zero-sum game. As Jim puts it, and I quote him on page 15, in the paper, in Detroit, certain unsecured creditor groups received less than the beneficiaries of the pension plans. Well, if so, it's because almost everyone thought low and moderate income pensioners living in the community, many without Social Security, had a higher moral claim to protection and they would contribute to the city's recovery. In closing, I note that all of Jim's alternatives would cut pension liabilities, largely through benefit reductions, and leave bondholders unscathed. We are presented with a process that has prejudged the outcome of how the burden of adjustment in fiscally stressed states gets shared, and it falls on pensions. Pensions are deferred compensation. To cut them breaks an employment promise and a contract. To do so under extreme duress should require a fair and transparent process with all the assets and the liabilities open for adjustment and all concerned parties around the table. Bonded debt and financial contracts shouldn't have a free pass. Remember, even with shared participation, labor markets like financial markets are going to react to cuts in compensation. After the broken employment promises, where are we going to get the bodies, you know, the cops, the firefighters, the teachers, the social workers, and the others, to deliver the essential public services that this paper says is the core mission we're trying to protect? Just a parting thought. Thanks.
Thank you, Carol. I appreciate your remarks. I did in the paper point out,
for example. Please turn on your
mic. You don't need that for me. I can hear
you. Okay. Maybe it just should be a conversation between the two of us. There are, I think, throughout the country, and I know from calls I get from issues, municipalities and states that need real help. And I think back in 1990s and in the early 2000s, it was a different situation. And even then, people talked about the problem. I am not saying that anybody wins in this. Chapter 9, everybody gets adversely affected. So if you go into a prepackaged Chapter 9, you will have bondholders and everybody else at risk. So I'm not saying that anybody is sacred. At the same time, I am afraid, and this is something that I am hearing now. We can pay it, we can solve it, just give it time. We have given it time, and it is now, in a number of situations, a real issue for both states and municipalities. And I think that we need to think about solutions to solve it when all else fails. Yes, if you can get it done voluntarily. But, you know, if you looked at Joe Nation's study, and I think the California, Marin County in that, there are going to be municipalities and even possibly CalSTRS that have significantly low funding. And with the demographics, you're not going to have the ability to make up the difference. So transgenerationally, the young workers are going to get hurt. And I think also this is going to come at a time in the next X number of years, whether it's within the next five or within the next two, when we're going to have an economic downturn. And the ability to address them and solve it and pass legislation at that time is harder. States going into bankruptcy, I testified before Congress on that. Both the National Conference of State Legislatures and the National Governors Association response to having states go into bankruptcy is, we don't want it, it's not necessary, and it will not help us. And those were not bondholders speaking. Those are elected officials and state representatives. There are legal and practical problems, and if we start putting states as a co-sovereign to the federal government through a federal bankruptcy process, the consequences of that could be worse than what the present problem is.
I don't think we're going to solve this. I guess my feeling here is there are very practical issues that are being dealt with around the country as we speak. I am not convinced that the scope of the problem is terrifying at this point. I think it is much better than it was, right? Because people have recognized it and are making differences, and because the economy has gotten better. And I don't doubt that there's at some point there will be another downturn. I'm enough of an economist to know that. How bad it will be, who knows? But the situation, as I see it, is being solved daily.
Okay, so we're going to agree to disagree on this.
Yeah, we're not going to. We're not going to reach an agreement.
We want to get to the audience, and I have a few questions for Jim. One, I'll just give you all these questions. One is, in the prepackaged bankruptcy, you still need agreement from the parties, and why is that not going to prolong the process as if you didn't have a prepackaged bankruptcy? The second thing is, towards the end of your paper, when you talk about the Constitution and constitutional amendment, you talk about the police powers of government, and that the federal contract clause has, in some cases, ruled in favor of that police power to the detriment of creditors. And that begs a question: why in Illinois, if the Constitution precludes any sort of adjustment to pensions, that someone couldn't make that case to the Supreme Court that the state of Illinois is crowding out its ability to provide police powers?
A couple of things. First of all, with regard to the prepackage, yes, you do the negotiations, you get people, you cut a deal, and you get people on board. There are numerous examples of doing it on the corporate side. You can do it on the municipal side. Having done a lot of municipal restructurings, it's getting people to come together. All you need is one accepting class, and you can provide appropriate treatment for the rest of the classes and have the plan confirmed. So I do not see that as an obstacle against it. And getting an accepting class is getting people to realize that through a settlement process and negotiation. That negotiation goes on earlier, hopefully. And that's what, the mayor talked about. And I think that's what people are coming to the conclusion, addressing these issues not right before everything fails, but when you start realizing that you need to find a solution.
And that's basically worked, and that's continued to work since before New York 75, but it's been going on. I think you asked a very interesting question, though, about why somebody hasn't taken the Illinois issue to the U.S. Supreme Court on that, and I suspect it. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I suspect it's because things haven't gotten bad enough.
Well,
right?
You
still have a functioning government.
Sorry.
You still have a functioning government.
Well, if you take the cost. If you look at Chembles from J.P. Morgan, if they were to pay the actuary required amount over 30 years, it would take 40% of their general funds, right, which is not sustainable for the state.
Well, this was a question I had on your segregated pension bankruptcy court. You know, how the hell do we – what is insolvent for a pension fund, right? How do you define it? What number do you pick?
Well,
I mean, they're still sending out checks, so this is not a cash. This is not.
What's the fiduciary duty? What's the fiduciary duty of the trustees of the pension fund?
Well, and they
when you're 35% funded,
and they keep
paying, and you're paying the full amount to the current retirees, and you have a diminishing contribution by current employees because it's going down. And what you're doing is you're asking for a real crisis down the line, where the pension funds aren't going to be able to pay those younger people.
Yes, and that's why you've had all the legislative actions to change the structure of benefits, to change the contribution rates both by employees and employer. All right? That's why you've done it, so that if you keep pushing the time out, what you're going to be paying out is going to be a substantially smaller amount. I'm not saying what's right. I'm only saying from sitting, because I've worn a fiduciary hat. If you're wearing a fiduciary hat, you're doing the best. Yeah. You're doing the best you can under those circumstances.
Tier one in a lot of places isn't going to start into effect for 20 some years. Within that 20 some years, there's a lot of economic distress that is going to occur.
All right, we should probably take questions from the audience, and you can over a drink. Answer that question if we could get to the Illinois or to the U.S. Supreme Court, would that work?
Well, and just because it, I mean, let me just say, the Attorney General did not appeal it because there wasn't presented a federal issue. There are people actually working on possibly creating a test case that will raise that. That's one of the issues that can be done in Illinois.
Okay, George.
Hi, Mike. George Friedlander, Court Street Group. One very quickie observation, then question. The quickie observation is that I'm kind of startled by the idea of making bondholders substantially more vulnerable in this process, which I have no doubt would dramatically increase borrowing costs for everybody, including those that don't have a problem. I think it would be an entirely new world. My question, though, starting with Jim, to my mind, at the local level, and looking at this more local level than the state level, competitiveness increasingly matters between cities, especially with technological change becoming so important, and that means service. That means infrastructure and the problem, Jim, of not being able to audit infrastructure needs. And it means technological competitiveness in an environment where cities that are not technologically competitive don't flourish. And I'm wondering how one puts those second and third issues into the equation in coming up with solutions.
Very quickly. Any plan that would be proposed under any of these proposals would, as you've probably seen, include economic development. You noticed Mayor Broden, and if you look at different things written, things I've written and other people have written, economic development is the high tide that lifts the boat. And the fact that you may be able to file a Chapter 9, I don't think should be disturbing to the market, because you need a resolution. There are certain rights and issues that will need to be resolved there, but there's a tradition of working those things out. Carol talks about the time of working it out. I think you can work those things out in a prepackage so that everybody has negotiated their position. It may be that you don't even need a Chapter 9 if you can negotiate it. And if you can't negotiate it with everybody to get them on board, then you use the Chapter 9.
Let's get the question in the back. We have
Hi, I'm Chris Berry from the University of Chicago. First, I just want to thank both of you for a really constructive and stimulating discussion on the topic over which there's obviously some disagreements, but this has been great. My question is for Jim. Part of your argument stems from the idea that many states or local governments have reached a point where they cannot pay more. And Carol, I think, rightly raises concerns about moral hazard, that we would many places would like to claim that they cannot pay more if there's some remedy that would be available to them as a result. And so I wonder, how do we know when a place cannot pay more as distinct from has chosen not to raise taxes or something? Would there be a test? And if so, what kind of test would we use to distinguish those places that truly cannot pay more versus those where they simply don't have the political will to raise taxes? How would we know?
Well, and the premise in both in a prepack Chapter 9 in a federal court with regard to pension funds, with regard to GORDAC, and also with regard, there would be because if you're impairing anybody's rights, there would be a court review of that and a determination. And so you'd have to make legislative findings and showing your ability to raise taxes, your reason why you can't raise them any further, the cuts you have made in the balancing of your budget, and the reason why you can't do it any further. And then there would be a determination of that. So, you know, there is a process to make that determination and disclosure of the basic financial facts. And that all determines whether it's fair, feasible, and in the best interest of the parties.
But the bottom line is that's not so easy to do. And it's done in arbitration all the time. What can the employer pay or
not? Get your mic on.
Can the employer pay or not pay? This one, sorry. It's done all the time in arbitration, not, you know, does the employer have the ability to pay or not the ability to pay? It's not easy to figure out, and it definitely is very short-term. It tends to be a very short-term calculation as opposed to a longer-term budget sustainability kind of argument.
Okay. I apologize. We do need to move on to our next session, so please ask Jim these questions in the...
I'm Don Boyd with Rockefeller College, University of Albany. I'm here with my colleague Iman Yin from Rockefeller Institute. We're going to talk about, first of all, thank you for the invitation. We're going to talk about analyzing the interplay between public pension finances and governmental finances. This is really largely based on some extensive work that Iman has done. So we and other researchers have examined the investment-related risks to public pension funds and their sponsoring governments using stochastic simulation models. We have scenarios of investment returns that vary stochastically. They generally use simple investment return assumptions. Returns follow the normal distribution. Asset returns and government tax revenue are assumed to be uncorrelated. And you see the little diagram to the right that shows you that. And we've modeled them exactly like this. The asset returns derive a pension finance model. Kind of externally, there's an assumption about what happens to government finances. And we often look, at least in our models, at required contributions relative to government tax revenue as one kind of indicator or measure of fiscal pressure. Did I do this right? Yeah. So the research suggests that the real world differs from these simple assumptions. Investment returns and tax revenue may be correlated through the business cycle. There may be non-normality in asset returns. A poor economy may cause investment returns to fall short of expectations. It may also cause tax revenue to fall short. So it could be that the increase in required contributions may cause additional fiscal pressure, certainly as measured relative to tax revenue. So, and the model kind of on the right depicts that, where business cycles and asset returns are correlated and business cycles have an impact on governmental finance. What we have done, really, this is largely Munn's work, is we've developed and linked a small macroeconomic and investment returns model to both a pension fund simulation model and to models of governmental tax revenue to try to get at this question of how this correlation could affect fiscal pressure. And we've got kind of five boxes, and Munn's going to talk about each of the boxes. I'll quickly give the overview. We have off on the left, it starts with an economic scenario generator that generates scenarios of real GDP growth and also asset returns. And on the top, the GDP growth and, in our case, stock returns affect the tax revenue of governments, and asset returns affect the pension simulation model. We then have stylized governments that, depending on the structure of their taxes, affects their tax revenue, and then we put that cyclical tax revenue together with the required contributions out of the pension simulation model to get at fiscal pressure. With that, I'm going to step down and let Munn talk about the rest of this.
Okay. Thank you very much, Don, for the introduction and the overview of the model. And so next, let's look at these major model components in greater detail. So first, let's look at the economic scenario generator. So we have built a small-scale macroeconomic model that can generate internally consistent stochastic scenarios of real GDP growth and asset returns. So for the GDP growth model, we want to capture the general historical pattern of business cycle, especially the length and frequency of recession periods in history. So we model the GDP growth using a two-regime Markov switching process that consists of an economic expansion regime and a recession regime. And we allow for the economy switch between these two regimes based on the estimated transition probability. And for the stock return model, we want to incorporate the observation that severe economic downturns usually come with severe market downturns. So we've also modeled stock returns using a two-regime process. So it has a high return, low volatility regime, which is aligned with the economic expansion regime for the GDP growth. And there is a low return, high volatility regime, which is aligned with the recession periods for the GDP growth. And this two-regime model structure also allow us to generate stock returns that has a fat tail characteristics that cannot be captured by the simple normal distribution. And for the bond return, in the current version of the model, we do not model them econometrically because they're the weak historical relationship to business cycle. Instead, in the simulation, when producing the simulated variables, we construct stochastic bond returns that have correlations to stock returns that are consistent with their historical correlations. So we do 2,000 simulations for each of these variables, and the simulation horizon is 30 years into the future. And then the simulated variables are fed into a model for tax revenue for of major individual tax categories. So in our model, we examine four major categories of taxes: the personal income tax, the general sales tax, the selective sales tax, and other taxes as a group. And the table on the right shows the tax structure for state and local governments. And in our paper, we just focus on the state government. And when doing the simulation, we decomposed the tax revenue growth into a long-term trend component and a cyclical component. So individual taxes can have different long-run behavior relative to the economy. For example, the progressive income taxes will generally grow more quickly than the economy, and have seen that the sales tax bases have been declining relative to the economy over time. But actually, the long-term trend can be heavily affected by the changes in the tax rules, which cannot be effectively projected into the future. So in our model, we just make a simple assumption that the politicians will adjust tax bases and rates to maintain their shares of the economy stable over the long run, but we allow for cycles around this long-term trend. And this figure shows the cyclical components of the major tax revenue sources and compare them against the cyclical component of real GDP growth. So we can see that both sales tax and both income tax and general sales tax have very prominent cyclical behavior, and the cyclical behavior in income tax is even more strong than the general sales tax. So some recent research suggests that important reason why income tax have stronger cyclical behavior is that it is not only affected by the economic conditions, it's also affected by how the business cycle affect the investment returns and in turn the capital gains from the asset value. So in the model for income tax revenue, we also incorporate the asset returns as the independent variable. So the total tax growth for each of the individual tax category are the sum of the cyclical growth rate and the trend growth rate. And we assume that the trend growth rate is 1.9% in real term, which is based on the CBO projection for the long-term GDP growth. And the cyclical growth rate is based on our estimated elasticity of the tax revenue with respect to GDP growth. And in the case of income tax revenue, also the elasticity with respect to stock returns. Okay. And then we combine the individual taxes to construct the total tax revenue of two stylized governments. The first one is the personal tax dominant state government, and the second one is the sales tax dominant state government. So here we plot the share of the individual income tax in the total tax revenue against the share of the general sales tax. So our sales tax dominant states represent states like Texas and Florida, where there's no personal income tax, and our personal income tax states represent states like California, New York, where income tax accounts for more than half of their total tax revenue. So here we have the tax structure we use in the simulation model. Okay, so by this point we have the simulated total tax revenue for the stylized government. And then we calculate the required pension contribution for this from this government using a pension simulation model. So this model takes the investment returns generated by the economics narrow generator, and then calculate the funding status and required government contribution to the pension fund for the 2000 stochastic simulation into the next 30 years. So by this point, we have the finances of the government and the finances of the pension fund all generated within the coherent simulation framework. And then we can combine that to examine the the compounding of risks from the correlated investment risk and the government finance. So we compare the stylized garments with the baseline model with no linkage between model components and alternative model structures where we have only a partial partial linkage. And we will see how pension-related risks can be understated if the linkage is ignored. And we also see when the linkage is taken into account, how the how the increase in the risk can be decomposed into different factors. And we look at two types of risks. The first one is a very high government contribution relative to tax revenue, and the second one is the sharp increase in employer contributions. And this table shows the risk measure for very high employer contributions, which is measured by the probability of employer contribution as a percentage of total tax revenue being more than 5 percentage points above the year one level in the simulation at any time during the next 30 years. So we have also simulated three different funding policies for the pension fund. And the first column is the benchmark, the baseline model, where there's no linkage between model components. Not surprisingly, you can see that the risk measure is the lowest among all model structures. And in the second column, we add linkage between GDP growth and asset returns. And the third column, we add the linkage between GDP growth and government finance. So both of these two model structures have partial linkage. We can see that the partial linkages will only lead to moderate increase in the risk of pension-related risks. But when we allow for the full model where we have a linkage between GDP growth, government finance, and asset return, we can see a sharp jump in the measure of risks. And we have the last two columns show the risk measure for the two stylized garments. You can see that the risk measure for the income tax dominant state is the highest among all columns because it allows for the correlation between government finance and the volatility in the capital market. So the conclusion is that it's very important to incorporate the correlation between risk between government finance and pension finance when evaluating the pension-related risks. And when that is taken into account, the risks can be even larger than commonly understood under simpler assumptions. So the results suggest that more stress testing and reporting are needed to better understand and communicate risks. And we hope that is the wave of the future. Okay, thank you.
All right, hi everyone. My name is Laura Quinby from the Center for Retirement Research, where I'm an economist, and now I get the joy of a PC and slides. Is anyone here good with that? Like any good academic, I have slides. Like any good academic, I can only use them on my own computer. Great, thank you. All right, thank you. So I am delighted to be discussing this paper by Iman and Don. I really want to congratulate them on a phenomenal amount of work. I can say from highly unpleasant experience that this type of model really involves a lot of coding and a lot of angst, and they've managed to pull it off. So the main takeaway that I brought from this paper is that government pension contributions are countercyclical, and that they're likely to grow at a time when governments can least afford them. And the authors present what I think is a really novel finding in the literature, that the stress is worse for states that have more pro-cyclical revenue streams, such as an income tax rather than a sales tax. And they also point out, I think, a more commonly accepted view that funding policies that amortize unfunded liabilities over a really long horizon push risks from current generations onto future generations. And the underlying sort of fact of this model is that assets in public pension funds have not only grown quite a lot in the last 20 years, but they've also become increasingly pro-cyclical. So what I've plotted here is just the market level of assets, the total market level of assets in the state and local pension funds over time. And you can see this dramatic run-up from 1993 to 2015, which was the latest year of data that I had, and also the increasing volatility of assets growing in expansions and declining in recessions. And both the growth and the volatility stem from portfolios that are very, very heavily invested in risky assets. So public pension funds currently have about 50% of their portfolios in equities, down from about 54% in 2001. Increasingly, they're turning to alternatives, having sort of been burned by the 2008 downturn. Alternatives are up from 15% to about 26% in 2015. And I noticed that Iman and Don weren't able to put alternatives into this iteration of the model, but I do think they're going to become more important in the future, and I do hope that they're able to model some different asset classes. So as a result, pension assets are now following more or less the same path as government revenue, which is what I put up here. This is just the one-year growth in market assets in the large pension funds relative to the one-year growth in own source revenue for those same government entities. And you can really see an emerging strong correlation between the two. But the interesting thing is that although the assets are pretty volatile and are tracking with revenues, pension funded ratios in the aggregate are not improving dramatically even when the economy has been performing well. So we can see that in 1990, the aggregate funded ratio was about 80%. And, of course, this is according to GASB standards. I'm not going to argue the discount rate here. It rose to over 100% funded in the late 1990s and early 2000s, leading a lot of analysts at the time to say that everything was all right. And then since then, they've fallen. And yes, there has been some recovery during expansions, but really, if you look at this figure, what you mostly notice is just a steady downward trend. And today, they're about 70% funded according to GASB standards. And I would like to actually bring in here, as I was listening to the conversation, we at the center really think of the plans as very heterogeneous. I've shown the aggregate funded ratio here, but about a third of them are doing very well, are well funded. About a third are acceptably funded. They should probably make changes to their funding regimes, but it's manageable. About a third are deeply stressed, and these are the ones I think we've been bringing up over and over, Illinois. And even in Illinois, we need to distinguish between Chicago and the IMRF, but also Kentucky, some plans in Massachusetts. So one reason for the secular decline in funded ratios is just that the sponsors have not paid their full arc since the late 1990s. And you do see some cyclicality here. Sponsors are more likely to make their full contributions when times are good than when times are bad, as one might expect. But what's remarkable is that even in the last few years when the stock market has been performing well, sponsors have not been making their full contributions. Sponsors also viewed low costs in the late 1990s as a chance to enhance benefits. So these were retroactive enhancements for both current employees and new hires, and they were unfunded in the sense that even though the plans were fully funded by GASB standards in 2000, since they were so heavily invested in equities, what goes up is likely to come down, and that was not taken into account at the time, at least by a number of sponsors, the bad apples that we're all thinking about. And you can see that these enhancements increase total liabilities per member immediately and permanently. So there's a clear break in the trend right around the time that all the enhancements were made. That break has not come down, although it started to slow in recent years. it's slowing because sponsors have been making cuts in response to funding pressures after the Great Recession. But because of many state statutes protecting the benefits of current members, these cuts are most often only for new hires. So as has been mentioned, it's going to take many years for the effects of these cuts to actually be fully represented in the liability. So as a result, required contributions are now at their highest levels since the early 1990s. And I'm going to wrap up here. I think that this is very interesting. We do see contributions under what the plan should be paying. So the black line is their required contribution. The red line is what they're actually paying relative to own source revenue. But we're not seeing a sort of cyclical pattern in the contributions right now. We're just seeing a steady increase for all of these political economy factors that I mentioned. So to conclude, I think this paper makes a really great point that heavy investment in risky assets in the pension fund is leading to countercyclical funding requirements. And there's an interesting finding in this paper that the problem is more acute in states that rely on an income tax rather than a sales tax for their revenue. In future work, I would encourage the authors to start including different asset classes in their modeling. But more importantly, I would encourage all of us to start trying to incorporate some political economy into our pension forecasting. I know it's really difficult, but I have a hard time thinking about how to forecast pension stress in over a 15-year period when the legislature is determining a lot of really important variables that we're taking for granted. So in particular, I'd like to relax the assumption of paying the full ARC. And I'd like to allow liabilities to start to vary along with the economy. Thank you.
I think because we left so many people stranded on the last two, we're going to start with questions. So this gentleman here. We have a microphone.
Josh Gottbaum, Brookings. Laura, you're one-third, one-third, one-third dichotomy. My question is this one-third measured by number of plans or measured by liabilities? And the reason for asking the question is that the set of issues that Jim Spiotta raised, depending on whether or not the distress is a third of the plans or a third of the dollars, affects whether we spend time on that issue.
Yeah, so I wish I'd put this slide in now in retrospect. So it's both number of plans and assets. It's about a third under both measures, which is sort of interesting in and of itself.
I noticed that your growth rate for sales tax was 1.9%. So have you thought about what it would be with the ability of state and local governments to tax internet sales?
In no way does this take internet sales into account. That's a real trend growth rate is what that is. That is inflation adjusted. So go ahead. Yeah, it keeps up with the economy.
There we go. Okay. So as Don said, this is the 1.9% is the trend growth, and will also allow for the cyclical change in the sales tax growth. And the 1.9% growth is the reason we use that is to make sure that the share of the sales tax revenue in the total tax revenue is stable over the long run. So because we cannot just project very accurately what will happen in the future due to the changes in the tax rules.
So any number of policy choices could get you there. For example, you could have a
continuation of the declining base and then bumping it up for internet sales. But in essence, that decline in the base is stopped in the simulations.
Okay. I think there's someone all the way in the back, and then we'll get Natalie.
Thanks. My question is a follow-up for Joe Fleming with the Pew Charitable Trust. I have a follow-up question for Laura based upon the funding. So for the third that are well-funded, third that are sustainable, and third that are deeply stressed, are the groups based upon their relative funding to or the pension plans' relative funding to one another, or an objective funding level that you determined where states are or should be?
Yeah, so obviously, and this has come up earlier, there is really no well-accepted objective level of what constitutes stress in this arena. How we just did it was we considered any plan that was below 50% funded to be troubled. And how they, and some, I think the plans that are falling into that category would be plans like Chicago that are about 30% funded and where multiple sources are concerned about trust fund exhaustion given their current contribution rates, which are statutorily set, not actuarially set. It's plans like that. Obviously, you could change the definitions however you like, and you would get different proportions. But I think the point I was trying to make here is that we really can't talk about all of the plans as a group facing the same types of pressures or problems. It really is, there are some that are much less financially sound than others.
So I would like to second the desire to have more done on alternative investments. They run the gamut, and so people kind of put this blanket, oh, they're alternative investments, and many people say, oh, bad. You know, not necessarily. I haven't looked in a while, but I know Missouri PERS is very heavily into a range of alternatives and seems to be managing okay. And then others know of the situation in Dallas where we had a lot of real estate investment that was way overvalued and caused tremendous heartache for the city. So I would say that and also the valuation of the assets and how that's done and sort of what the governing principles are for the valuations, I think are really important areas of future study.
We, Iman and I, will make a trip to Boston soon. We hope to speak with Laura and her colleagues and talk about especially the alternatives and other asset classes.
Hi, this is all really interesting. I'm wondering how... Hi, I'm Kim Rubin from the Urban Institute. Sorry. How did demographics, right? This came up in the last session, but in your models, you know, beyond the tax information, the demographics of the state or locality especially is also going to affect how this is going to play out in the future, right? And it also is going to affect how much they can put in or not. Is that in your model somehow? And is there a way of playing with how population changes will fit into, like, whether people are worse off or not? I just keep worrying that if you try and increase the amount you're putting in this or anything else where you're trying to sort of build up solvency, you can actually make it worse through sending people going away from the place.
So two things. So in our assumption for economic growth, the 1.9% long-term trend GDP growth is based on the CBO projection that has incorporated the long-term projection for demographic change. In our pension simulation model, we assume that the workforce will also grow at the same rate as the population. This also, so I think that's around 0.5% annually, but we can also change the assumption for demographic growth, population growth, or the workforce growth to see what will happen under different assumptions of the demographic changes.
Thank you.
And so we have a plain vanilla economy like the national average, okay? Could we look at alternatives? It would probably require some real thought about what that alternative would look like, you know? Sure, yeah.
I think the point you're making is that maybe the correlation between asset return and economic decline are higher when you take into account individual mobility from state to state, right? I can flee a poor performing state when times are bad.
Yes.
And an aging workforce.
Right.
Well, the aging workforce is built into the 0.5%.
Oh, yeah.
Not all states are aging equally, but there are, yeah, but the aging workforce.
Right. The aging public sector workforce is in the model. You know, if there's some change in the characteristics of the economy itself that somehow mean GDP is not a good measure of capacity to pay, we haven't captured that.
I just keep coming back to Clint.
Right. Right. Well, those are great questions. We're kind of like, I think we made a step. A big step, I'd like to say, and thanks to Iman.
Other questions? Any closing thoughts from the discussants or presenters? I think we're done a little early then.
No?
Oh, okay. That's at 10:30, no?